From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend.
Don't be scared, okay? You're gonna do great. All we need is one good egg.
That egg is for in vitro fertilization. Katherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti star in the new comedy Private Life as a couple in their 40s trying to have a baby and going through fertility treatments while also trying to adopt, and it's taken over their lives. Today we talk with the film's writer and director, Tamara Jenkins, who also wrote and directed the comedies Slums of Beverly Hills and The Savages. Also, New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos talks about his recent article, Can Mark Zuckerberg Fix Facebook Before It Breaks Democracy? And David Edelstein reviews the new version of A Star Is Born, starring Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga.
Even if you normally roll your eyes at stuff like this, it's hard to resist.
That's on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tamara Jenkins has written and directed a new comedy about a couple in their 40s trying to have a baby through any means necessary. Fertility drugs, in vitro fertilization, egg donor, adoption. It's consuming all their time and their money and leading to arguments over what to try and how long to keep at it. Jenkins writes about fertility treatments from the perspective of having been through them with her husband when she was in her early 40s. They now have an 8-year-old daughter. Jenkins also wrote and directed the comedies Slums of Beverly Hills and The Savages. Jenkins and her husband Jim Taylor co-wrote the screen adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel Juliet Naked, which is currently in theaters. Her new film Private Life is now in theaters and streaming on Netflix. Let's start with a scene. Katherine Hahn plays Rachel, a writer, married to Richard, a theater director, played by Paul Giamatti, who's actually making a living with his gourmet pickle business. They live on a limited budget in the East Village in Manhattan. The fertility treatments have already taken a lot out of them when the fertility doctor tells Rachel that her best bet is finding an egg donor. That is not something she wants to do, and she lets Richard know it as they walk down the street after leaving the fertility clinic.
There's no way in hell I'm doing that.
Yeah, we should at least just think about it. I'm not saying that we would do it, right? We can just explore the idea, see how we feel. Make a list of all the pros and cons.
We talked about this. We swore we would never do it.
No, you swore that you would never do it. I kept my mouth shut because I didn't want to pressure you into something that you were going to have to live with for the rest of your life.
Wait, so all this time that I'm assuming that we feel the same way about this, you've been having secret fantasies about egg donation?
It's not a secret fantasy.
It is to me. I didn't know about it. I thought that we had decided together as a couple that we would definitely draw the line at science fiction.
It's not science fiction, Rach. It's pretty primitive, actually. They do it with farm animals all the time.
Well, I'm not a goat, okay?
Bad example. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. You're, like, so gung-ho right now. It's, like, it's freaking me out.
I am not gung-ho. I'm just pragmatic. Look. If we do another IVF with your eggs, we've got, what, a 4% chance of getting pregnant? With a donor egg, we'd be going from 4 to, like, 65%. So, I mean, the gambler in me just wants to put my money on the better odds.
Oh, my God. You're Guy Woodhouse.
What?
The husband in Rosemary's Baby, John Cassavetes, that's you.
Yeah, right, that's me, standing by while you're raped by a satanic demon. I am just suggesting that we listen to our doctor and look into all the options. We're already signed up for adoption. What is the big deal?
Well, for one, I'm not putting someone else's body parts into my uterus. Oops. Excuse me.
Sorry. Okay. I know it's more complicated for
is
you.
Is it more complicated for you,
yes,
too?
Of course it is. Yes. Yes. But you heard him. There's a lot of positives. You would get to carry the baby.
Oh, whoop-de-doo. What does that make me, the bellhop?
Ouch.
Ouch.
Tamara Jenkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. That just is an example of both the comedy and drama combined in your movie and the problems and friction that this long process can have on a couple. You know, the last time we spoke was in 2007, after the release of your movie, The Savages. And at the end of the interview, because we had talked about your father, who was a very problematic figure in your life, I asked you if you wanted to become a parent, having been through having less than perfect parenting as a daughter. And you said that at the end of our interview, I'm married and we're actually pursuing a family, but we're definitely on the late side of that. I didn't get married until I was 40. So
yeah,
you are the same age when I interviewed you last in 2007 as Catherine Hahn plays in your new movie. And I'm assuming that when we did that interview in 2007, you were in the process of trying to conceive.
We were.
And were you thinking, that's going to be my next movie?
No, I definitely wasn't thinking it was going to be my next movie. And I, when we were in the throes of it, there was no, although there's always that kind of perverse part, I think, of a writer or an artist that has the third eye in the middle of their forehead and they're kind of watching life as it's unfolding. So maybe sometimes even in the most unsightly times or places, they are kind of recording what's happening. So, you know, but that's not conscious, but it must be happening somehow.
So at what point did you know that is going to be the subject of my movie, trying to conceive?
I had a good friend when I was going through when my husband and I were in the process of doing our own, you know, artificial reproductive technology / adoption by any means necessary approach to trying to have a baby. I had a friend, a girlfriend, her name's Rebecca, and she's a documentary filmmaker, and she was my confidant. And when I spoke to her about what was happening, she always said, you know, you should write this stuff down. This would be really great material for a movie. And I was horrified and just repulsed. And was like, that is never going to happen, Rebecca. I would never write about this stuff. And obviously now I have a movie and I did write about it. And I don't know exactly when I thought it was legal, emotionally legal to pursue for myself. But I did notice, and actually Rebecca is one of the people among my friends soon after my own struggle with trying to figure out how to get a baby. A lot of people I knew were starting to fall into that situation also. So I felt like it was almost a mini epidemic among my friends, and who were a very specific kind of subset of New York people who had unusual lives, sort of freelance lives. They were writers and artists and filmmakers and journalists, and they didn't have, you know, steady income in the same sort of, nothing was regular. That maybe they didn't have health insurance, maybe they held on, like, not unlike the characters in the movie, they held on to their, you know, New York existence by their fingernails because they had a rent stabilized apartment. They had tiny apartments. How are they gonna start families? They were pursuing their career, and then suddenly they looked around and realized that they were, you know, 40 or over, and oh my God, we better, you know, they were arriving late to the table.
So, spoiler, how many children, do you have children?
I do. I have an 8-year-old who's almost 9.
Is that Mia to whom the film is dedicated?
It is.
Okay, and can
Very
I just
good
ask
eyes.
before we talk?
I always think nobody's going to see that because it's like at the very, very end, like right before, you know, thanking New York State for letting us shoot here. And like no one's sticking around for that.
Do you mind me asking if you adopted, if you did IVF?
We did do IVF. We actually were pursuing, not unlike the characters in the movie, although sort of differently, we were pursuing international adoption and IVF simultaneously. We were doing those things at the same time. It was kind of like whatever happens first wins, and IVF won, and we got pregnant and finally had Mia Taylor, who was my daughter.
So the movie starts with the Catherine Hahn character on her bed in her bikini underwear, lying on her hip. It's a kind of sexy pose. But what's really happening is that she's waiting for her husband to inject her with whatever the hormone is that she's getting at that moment. And it's a great shot to show how what should be a very sexual process, do you know what I mean? Like making love and then conceiving. When you're having to go through fertility treatments, it's like it's injections and pills and, you know, all this stuff that's like not only not sexy, but it also kind of is going to have an effect on your body because you're ingesting all these hormones.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you talk about that shot? Can you talk about like framing it as something that looks like it's going to be really sexual.
Erotic.
And it's not.
And there's also sound. So before you kind of come into the scene, you're hearing Paul, and Paul has that amazing kind of whispery voice, and mm-hmm. he's saying scoot over, and mm-hmm. you're hearing breath, and it sounds sort of like you're overhearing kind of a bedroom scene, and then you arrive, and then it's a shot of Catherine's lower haunch. You don't see any heads, or it's not attached. It's kind of her lower body laid out on the bed, and then Paul arrives above her and pulls her underpants down a little bit to expose sort of her haunch, and you see a wedding ring, and he lowers it, and then he says, are you ready? And she says, yeah. And he's like, okay, here we go. And he starts counting 1, 2, 3, and you think they're gonna like try some new erotic act because there's all this preparation, and instead he lifts up a hypodermic needle, and an intramuscular needle, and you know, spears it into her butt. And then you cut wide and you see, wow, that is not a sex scene. That is a medical situation.
And to compare it to, say, pregnancy, like instead of the husband putting his hand or the partner putting their hand on, you know, the pregnant belly, feeling their baby inside, he's kind of like stabbing her with needles in her belly and her hip. And again, it's just, it's not the moment that you dream of when you dream of having a baby and what that's going to be like. It can lead right to that moment, but that process is just so different.
Yeah, it's pretty alienating in the body department. I mean, and then, of course, it's even taken to a new level when instead of having your husband inseminate you, you're lying in a, you know, kind of a, with stirrups and having a, you know, endocrinologist between your legs with some strange catheter device saying, okay, let's get pregnant. And it's not your husband, it's the doctor. That's pretty strange, too.
And you shoot those scenes in the stirrups in the fertility clinic from the point of view of Catherine Hahn. So you're seeing the doctor, you're seeing her legs on the stirrups through her point of view. It's a point
knees
of view so many women have had so many times. I have to say, the doctors don't come off very well in your movie. Was that your experience?
I actually had great doctors. It's a very bizarre job. I love Dennis O'Hare, who played Dr. Dordick, and it's a weird job because there's a salesmanship. I mean, first of all, you know, it's not an indictment about the fertility industry, because the fertility industry makes amazing things occur, but it's not an easy fix.
Well, that leads to another scene that I want to play. The Catherine Hahn character is a writer, and she has a new book that's about to be published, a novel that's called Women's Studies. And her agent calls her and says, have you seen the cover? And Catherine Hahn says, no. And so she runs to her email to open the PDF of the cover. And she looks at the cover and she's horrified because the cover is of, you know, Catherine Hahn's a feminist and the character. And in the novel, on the cover, there's a woman in this like white flowing dress and a field of like purple and green. And it's so, quote, feminine, like old-fashioned feminine. And so she's mortified. And so here's the conversation she has with her husband afterwards, who's played by Paul Giamatti. I should mention that as they're talking, she's finishing brushing her teeth.
I just feel so betrayed.
By what?
You know, the bull I was fed in college. Feminist ideology. You know, the lie that I could have a career and then kids. Well, obviously that hasn't panned out. Should send them the bills for our IUIs and IVFs.
You can't blame second wave feminism for our ambivalence about having a kid.
I'm not ambivalent.
No, now you're not, because you realize that the boat is leaving the dock. But before, you kept changing the deadline, remember? We'll start as soon as I finish the play. Right after I get the story published. Once I finish the book.
Are you blaming me?
No, I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying that we need to take some responsibility for the situation.
A lot of women have babies at 41. I thought I could too.
Okay. I just don't think it's Gloria Steinem's fault that we can't get pregnant.
Whose fault is it then? I guess it is mine, because I was too busy writing my stupid book.
I didn't say that.
Ugh, all the doctors ever talk about is my advanced maternal age, my old eggs. And we're in the middle of an IVF, and oh, what a surprise. Your sperm is like on a sabbatical.
Whoa, what the hell is that supposed
Nothing.
To mean?
So that was Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti in a scene from my guest Tamara Jenkins' new movie, which is called Private Life. So did you have this kind of conversation in your head when you were trying to conceive in your early 40s and wondering if it was just too late, if you'd waited too long? Did you play both parts here in your own mind?
Yeah. You mean blaming myself?
Yeah.
Blaming
were you like Paul
world?
Giamatti and Catherine Mind and Catherine Hahn in your head having that argument with yourself?
Yeah, I think I was. I think that that's fair. A kind of, you know, how did I end up here? I mean, her blaming second wave feminism for her. I mean, it's such a demented thing to do, but then I sort of understand what she's saying. I remember my producer was trying to follow the logic of the writing, and she was like, well, she sort of leaps to the, and I said, you know, it's sputtering. This isn't like a rational, this is a kind of upset, sputtering person. Then this is what's flying out of her mouth. It's not a well thought out argument, but I get it on an emotional level. I get why she feels betrayed by some notion of like, you know, be independent and you don't need, you know, pursue your career. And it's not like Gloria Steinem ever said that exactly. You know, she really can't be blamed. But I know what Catherine's character is talking about, some sense of like license to pursue your the other part of your life, not the wife part, not the mother part, but the other part. And then suddenly she feels like the rug has been pulled out from under her, and this thing that she delayed is now possibly not available to her.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film Private Life, which is currently in theaters and streaming on Netflix. We'll talk more after a break, and David Edelstein will review the new version of A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed Slums of Beverly Hills, The Savages, and the new movie Private Life, which is now in theaters and streaming on Netflix. Private Life stars Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti as a couple in their 40s trying to have a baby through any means necessary, fertility drugs, in vitro fertilization, egg donor, adoption. Trying to have a baby has become like a full-time job for each of them. It's emotionally draining, and it's draining their savings, too. It's also become a source of friction in their relationship.
I think it's fair to say that in your movie, you give pretty equal weight to how the husband and wife are experiencing trying to conceive or to adopt. And they each have their own like emotional crises that they have to go through. And I think it's interesting that you did that. You didn't just try to do the woman's point of view and have the man be like totally uncomprehending and cold and, you know, not going through his own issues.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. And I love Paul's portrait of Richard, her husband. And I think when I set out to do it, I remember thinking to myself, oh, this is a mutual midlife crisis. This is happening to both of them. And in a way, sometimes I think of it like a buddy movie. And I did this with The Savages, too. When you're writing something that's so character-driven, sometimes you need to create order in your brain because it's not a genre. And I remember thinking with this that it was like a buddy movie. And instead of getting in a car and driving across the country, I don't know, a bank heist or something, they're getting in a car and driving through, like, infertility land. It was important to me that it was a mutual, I don't know, crisis that it wasn't just her problem. Or, I mean, they're both falling apart. They're hitting up against the limitations of being a human being simultaneously. It's not just her.
You know, when he has to do the sperm donation, he's watching really awful, looks like really cheap, awful porn.
And it looks
like that was supplied by the fertility clinic. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's what they do. That's always such a bizarre, like if you go, you know, you open a drawer at a doctor's office and it's stuff with porn magazines, it just seems like somebody actually had to go out and go shopping for those and bring them to the office. Like, that's a, you know, that's medicine. I don't know. It's, you know, a medical office and somebody has to go down the street and pick out some porn magazines and some videos.
Well, Paul Giamatti's just like rolling his eyes. Instead of getting aroused, he's rolling his eyes at the porn. I was hoping I'd find something better. Do you know what I mean? Like something.
Yeah, yeah. It's not very good quality.
It's not
right?
very good quality. Yeah. Okay. So during the process of when trying alternate paths of either conceiving through various fertility treatments or of adoption, did you have to like ask yourself, what would it mean for a child to really feel like your child?
Yeah. But then I think something kind of takes, I mean, there is this presumption as a heterosexual couple that you have all the equipment to do this old-fashioned thing, which is to, you know, give birth to a child that represents half of you and half of your partner. And when it is taken away for some reason, I think it's traumatizing at first. And then I think kind of like the characters in the movie, you tiptoe towards different ideas of what it's really about. Is it about giving birth to a baby or is it about becoming a parent? What is the end goal? And it just starts changing and shifting. I always find it really interesting when people, like in the movie, there's like a lot of, I don't know if the right word is comedy of manners, or like when people are just saying, oh my God, I don't know why don't they just adopt? And just is always italicized. Like, oh my God, why would they be going through this? Why don't they just adopt? As if adopting is just the easiest thing on the planet. Like, oh, you just go out to, you know, Target and pick up a kid or something. It's very difficult to adopt. I mean, it's complicated. Egg donation is complicated. IVF is complicated. Every way you have to get a baby that isn't lying in bed and having sex is complicated. And people are so judgmental from the outside. Like, well, why don't they just adopt? There's all these children out in the world that need adoption. And nobody says that to people that go and have sex. Nobody climbs into their bed and say, oh, no, why are you having sex right now? To have a baby because there's all these unwanted children out there. You should go, you know, it's so presumptuous. It's so interesting. And it's such a hot button thing for people. I remember when my husband and I were in the throes of our fertility stuff, realizing that the people that I should be talking to the most for comfort and perspective were all my gay friends. Because any of my gay friends that were trying to have babies had to pursue complicated arrangements to get their kids. They didn't have the opportunity to just lie in bed and have sex and have a baby. So that was so normalized in gay people that want to have babies that I really was like, this is where I should hang out. I shouldn't hang out with all the heteros that have had such a great way where they can get drunk and lie in bed and have sex and have a baby. I'm just hanging out with all my gay friends because they know what this feels like, because they have to figure out an unusual path to getting a child, not the, you know, old-fashioned way, let's put it that way. So I really found like that was a safe place to be, and it gave me a lot of perspective.
Tamara Jenkins wrote and directed the new movie Private Life. It's currently in theaters and streaming on Netflix. She also co-wrote the film adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel Juliet Naked, which is also out in theaters. The new film A Star is Born opened this weekend. It was directed and stars Bradley Cooper and gives Lady Gaga her first lead film role as a hopeful singer-songwriter. This is the fourth version of A Star is Born. The original, made in 1937, was directed by William Wellman and starred Frederick March as a fading alcoholic movie star and Janet Gaynor as the aspiring actress he falls in love with, who becomes a sensation. In 1954, it was remade as a musical with Judy Garland and James Mason. The 1976 version paired Barbra Streisand and Kris Kristofferson.
Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new A Star is Born.
The first thing you'll notice in Bradley Cooper's crowd-pleasing remake of A Star is Born is that Lady Gaga, the artist who rode to fame with avant-garde stunts and a firm refusal to do anything natural, anything that didn't smack of artifice, is down to earth and completely winning. You come to see a star and discover a human being, become a star. Gaga's character Ali works in a hotel and performs on occasion at a drag bar, which is where she's discovered by country western superstar Jackson Maine, played by Cooper. He's not there for the floor show. He fled his limo after finishing a bottle of vodka and staggered into the first watering hole. Then Ali saunters onto the stage, transforms La Vie en Rose into the sultriest of ballads, and ends up writhing under Jackson's nose on top of the bar. Of the four versions of A Star is Born, this one has the cutest meat, and subsequent scenes, when Ali and Jackson talk all night, are even more charming.
Can I ask you a personal question? Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Well, because, like, almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
Your nose is beautiful. Are you showing me your nose right now?
Yeah.
You don't have to show it to me. I've been looking at it all night.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I'm going to be thinking about your nose for very long.
You're full of
I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah.
Can I touch your nose?
Oh, my gosh.
Let me just touch it for a second. You're very lucky.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not really. That my nose has not made me lucky.
Jackson loves her nose and her music, which is why he memorizes a song of hers he heard only once, plays it before a sold-out stadium crowd, and calls for Ali to join him on stage, which she does reluctantly. It's one of those scenes in which the musicians don't know the song, but as they play along, they get it. Hey, this is good. While Ali melts the hearts of everyone on earth. Yes, the performance goes viral. Even if you normally roll your eyes at stuff like this, it's hard to resist. The camera is handheld and mostly at eye line with the characters, breathlessly worshipful, then intimate, then worshipful. There's a reason that A Star is Born has been made four times. It's a Cinderella story in which the prince validates everything good about an impoverished young woman. He makes her a princess, and then garishly self-destructs before her horrified eyes, a rescue fantasy and a masochistic wallow in one neat package. I can't imagine how the first half of this A Star is Born could be much better. It's so good, it will carry people through the second half, which has great scenes, but the usual mushy arc. Cooper and his co-screenwriters haven't rethought the material for 2018, an age in which celebrity apparatus involves making stars and their personal lives seem closer to us via Twitter and Instagram. When a reptilian Brit becomes Ali's manager and steers her towards bland dance pop, you can't tell what Ali thinks about the song she's doing. And there's no point where Lady Gaga breaks through and shows the subversiveness that made her a star. Yes, she's playing a character, but why cast her and then keep her straitjacketed? She all but drops out of the picture while Jackson hits bottom after bottom. Cooper's performance grips you, though, even behind a full beard, long hair, and a squint. It took me a few seconds to place his basso purr. Then I thought, of course, it's Sam Elliott. Then Elliott showed up as Jackson's much older brother and long-suffering caretaker, and it's a trip hearing them growl at each other in the same voice. The most shocking scene in all versions of A Star is Born takes place at an awards ceremony, the Oscars or Grammys, in this case the Grammys. This one tops them all in the humiliation department. It's excruciating. Towards the end of the movie, I heard sniffles and noses being blown all over the theater. Man, this material is shameless, and man, does it work. Whatever its lapses, A Star is Born will be a monster hit. Audiences will love Cooper for his tender suffering on screen and for showing us the soul that was always there beneath Lady Gaga's outrageous costumes. They'll want to see Gaga at the Oscars as much as fans in the movie want to see Ali at the Grammys.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, we talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos about his latest article, Can Mark Zuckerberg Fix Facebook Before It Breaks Democracy? This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, Facebook announced the most serious security breach in the company's history, in which an unknown hacker was able to log onto the accounts of at least 50 million Facebook users. But that's just one element of the crisis facing the world's largest social media platform. Facebook was the conduit for a Russian-backed disinformation campaign in the 2016 election that reached tens of millions of its users. And the political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica got access to the personal information of 87 million Facebook users, which they used to target messages for the Trump campaign. Facebook is now under investigation by the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, and authorities in Europe and Australia. Our guest, New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, explores Facebook's history and profiles its 34-year-old founder and chief executive Mark Zuckerberg in a recent issue of the magazine. He says Zuckerberg's relentless drive to expand Facebook's reach has jeopardized the privacy of its users and made it vulnerable to political manipulation. His story is titled Ghosts in the Machine: Can Mark Zuckerberg Fix Facebook Before It Breaks Democracy? He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Evan Osnos, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, we all know Facebook is a very big deal. Give us a sense of its size and reach.
There's really nothing quite like it in the history of American business. It is now 2.2 billion monthly active users, meaning it's larger than any country in the world. It's really got no natural precedent when you look at the history of enterprise. It's really closer in terms of scale and reach to a political ideology or a religious faith. I mean, just in literal terms, it now has as many adherents as Christianity. And that has all been built in the last 14 years since it was founded in 2004.
For this piece, you visited Mark Zuckerberg at his home, at his office. You had numerous meetings, a lot of access from a guy who was pretty careful about, you know, journalists getting connected to him. How did you convince him to share so much time with you?
Well, he did it, I should say, reluctantly. This was a long process that started a year ago when I first approached them about the idea of this kind of story. I said, look, we do in The New Yorker these very long, detailed profiles. And I think initially Facebook's view was, we don't need to do this. We're a big, powerful company. And I continued to work on it, basically started interviewing a lot of other people around Facebook, people who worked there in the past, people who worked there in the present. And as that accumulated, I continued to say, look, this fundamentally should be about how Mark Zuckerberg sees the world. And over time, they came to, I think, sort of grudgingly, but I'm grateful for it, accept the idea that to an extraordinary degree, Mark Zuckerberg is Facebook. I mean, that is the reality. He's the chairman. He's the CEO. He controls 60% of the voting share. So if you're going to understand Facebook in any meaningful way, the conversation really has to start with him and end with him. And for that, I think they ultimately recognized he had to be a part of this project. The company has come up against a growing and really serious decline of public trust, both among politicians and among the general public. And I think they recognize that at the core of that, and I think he recognizes that, there is this profound question mark around what does Mark Zuckerberg believe in? What does he stand for? What does he care about? How does he see his role in the country? What does he see for the role of technology? And this project was my attempt to try to answer some of those questions for myself and for readers.
Zuckerberg started Facebook when he was at Harvard. It takes off and it grows because they're determined to get more users, to connect more people, as Zuckerberg likes to say. And you're right that in about 2007, it plateaued at about 50 million users, which a lot of other kind of similar platforms had done. What did the company do to break through that ceiling?
Well, they first panicked, really. There was a sense internally that they wondered whether they'd sort of hit the wall and whether this thing that had grown so fast was now over. And what they did was they discovered something important, which is that in order to punch through that wall, they had to come up with a whole range of new ways of accessing new populations, people who wouldn't otherwise have been on Facebook. The first thing they did was they discovered they simply had to translate the site into other languages, make it available to other countries around the world and allow people to be able to post in Spanish and so on. And by doing that, they crossed this barrier, this moat, which had prevented other social media sites from growing. But it did something even more important, which was that it established the sacred importance, really sacred is the word, of growth internally. They created a team called the Growth Team, which became, as a former Facebook executive said to me, it was really the cool crowd. This was the team everyone wanted to be on, was growth. It was about really sanctifying the idea of growth as an end in itself, that if Facebook stopped growing, then its whole reason for being would cease to exist. And that idea ended up becoming the dominant fact of the next decade, from 2007 until today, when Facebook became extraordinarily focused on whatever it could do to continue growing year after year.
And one of the things they did was that they made it a platform for outside developers, so that maybe you want to explain what this means, so that other software developers could hitch into Facebook and use it.
They made a big choice, which was that instead of saying we're just going to be our own site, we're actually going to try to become a platform, like almost like an operating system, the way that Windows used to be, the way that everybody went on to their personal computer, and then you would build applications on top of that. And that decision to open themselves up as a platform meant that they were then sharing data to a much larger group of developers, of programmers, than they otherwise would. And this turned out to be a fateful decision, because if you fast forward many years later to what we all now know as the Cambridge Analytica scandal, it was directly a result of this decision to open themselves up as a platform. Because what they'd done was they'd allowed an academic researcher to use some of the data on the platform to build a personality quiz. But then he sold that data to the political consultancy known as Cambridge Analytica. And that sort of backdoor, the way in which that data went out the door, has created much of the crisis that now engulfs the company today.
And you write that an executive within Facebook, Sandy Parakilis, was put in charge of looking into what these outside, app developers were doing with the data that they got from the Facebook users who, plugged into their games. What did he find?
What he found unnerved him. Sandy Parakilis had joined Facebook in 2011 and was one of the people responsible for going out and figuring out whether the data that they were giving to developers was being misused in any way. Were people violating privacy? Were they taking more data than they were supposed to? And what he found was that they were. In some cases, programmers, for instance, were siphoning off people's pictures and their private messages. In other cases, he found a developer that was building essentially shadow profiles for people who'd never given their consent, including for children. And it was, this was a case in which there was just a feeling of it being the Wild West. This data was out there and nobody was paying attention. And he raised alarms internally. As he tells the story, what he did was he said, look, we need to do a major audit to go out and figure out where is our data, who has it, and how are they using it. And as he says, he was told that's not going to happen, because if you do it, you may not want to know what you're going to find, meaning that they may have already lost control of so much of that data that they didn't really want to discover the full reach. And Sandy Parakilis left, but in many ways, his warnings turned out to be prophetic, because exactly the kind of undisciplined use of data which he had warned about and tried to raise greater alarms about internally turned out to be the origins of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which became so consuming for the company this year.
So a lot of resources within the company devoted to pushing growth, not so much into doing it responsibly.
Yes, exactly. As he said, you know, I needed people, I needed engineers to help me try to police where this data was going, but all of the resources were going to growth. He said at some point, he told me that the growth team had engineers coming out of their ears. They had everything they wanted. Everything was devoted to growing, and it was not devoted to making sure that what they were doing at the time was safe.
What are some of the other things the company did to keep growing that kind of pushed the boundaries of privacy?
Well, they began to build in lots of ingenious details into the design of the site. Things like autoplay videos. This is something as simple as changing the nature of Facebook so that when you scroll down your page, that the videos would begin to play without you having to click on them. What that was essentially taking advantage of some of our own psychological wiring. That means that just eliminating that small obstacle makes you much more likely to stay on the site, to watch that ad, and ultimately to consume whatever advertising is around it. And they did other things. They, for instance, you know, you remember in the very beginning, Facebook used to have pages, single pages. You'd have to click onto the next page. They got rid of that. So it's just a continuous scroll. And all of these little tiny details were in a way making Facebook into a new generation of behavioral experts. They figured out how do you tweak people's vanities and their passions and their susceptibilities and their desires in order to keep them on the site. The most important thing Facebook could do, and this is how they measured it, was make sure that people were signing on and staying on. But as you know, somebody put it to me, the problem with that is that eventually you exhaust the positive ways of boosting that engagement, and eventually you start to look at what this person described as the dark patterns, the ways that you can use anxiety or vanity to try to get people to sign on. One of the things they discovered, for instance, was that if you send somebody an email that says that a Facebook friend has uploaded a picture of them to Facebook, that people are almost incapable of resisting the temptation to look. And that sort of tweak, that just minor behavioral nudge, turned out to be really hugely important to the growth of Facebook.
Now, Facebook is in a lot of trouble these days because of data breaches, its role in elections. But you write that some former Facebook executives are voicing doubts about the company's role for other things, exacerbating isolation, outrage, addictive behaviors. You want to give us an example?
This is a big change for Facebook. Traditionally, its former executives have been silent. They leave the company and very often don't say much about it. Starting last year, Sean Parker, who was Facebook's first president, he's a sort of well-known Silicon Valley figure, gave an interview in which he said that, as he put it, he's become a conscientious objector to social media. He said, God knows what it's doing to our children's brains. And then a few days later, there was another very prominent former Facebook executive named Chamath Palihapitiya, who had been the head of growth, the vice president of user growth, which was an absolutely central position at the company for a number of years. And he came out and said, you know, in the back of our minds, we all had a sense that something might be going wrong, that our product, the thing that we were building, I'm paraphrasing here, was, as he put it, contributing to the breakdown of social discourse, the breakdown of society. And he said he would never let his children use this kind of product. I think because the public face of the company has been so on message about how they contribute in their minds to doing good in the world, to have some very senior former executives come out and talk about what the public has come to believe, which is that there are these very serious side effects to the company's growth, was a real wake-up call, externally and I think somewhat internally.
You talked to Zuckerberg a fair amount about this, you know, pushing of boundaries of privacy to grow. How does he regard this kind of experimentation now?
Well, he absorbed a central belief early on in his career, and I think it's become just key to understanding why he's made choices that he has and some of the mistakes that he has, which is that he decided early on that he was very often going to be criticized. He said, look, this is just a fact of what we do. As he said, look, we're not selling dog food here. We're doing something intensely, inherently controversial. It's at the intersection of psychology and technology. And so when people criticize Facebook for being too casual about their privacy, for allowing data to get out into the world, very often what he came to believe was that they would criticize him at the time, but over time, eventually they would accept it, they would get used to it, and they would keep signing on, they would keep growing. And that idea about criticism really hardened and became a central governing principle at Facebook, this sense that they were leaders, they were pioneers, they were forging ahead. They had to push the public beyond its comfort zone when it came to being less private, because if they didn't do it, then people wouldn't go there. But they were convinced that even in the cases of controversy, when you had civil libertarians or regulators or politicians or ordinary members of the public complaining about Facebook, that that was simply a sign that they were being bold. And that idea continued really until the present day.
Yeah, is it true that in 2010 he said privacy is no longer a social norm?
He did, and it caused a big uproar at the time. He said, look, this is a generational difference. We don't feel the same way about privacy that our parents and grandparents did. And people said, that's wild. That's not right. Privacy is built into the very nature of the United States. It's really embedded in the Bill of Rights, and his belief was that it was, as it was often described, an antique, and that we needed to push people further. There was, in the early days of Facebook, there was a theme, a phrase that was bandied about called radical transparency, the idea that you had to be aggressively transparent in order to be modern. The sense was, as one person had put it, in the future, because of Facebook and other things like it that were exploding the boundaries of privacy, that extramarital affairs would become impossible. People couldn't hide things like that. They could no longer hide their lives outside of work from their lives in work. And they believe that to be a virtue, this sense that there would be this fusion, this union of our private selves and our public selves. But that put them at odds with the public. And the key fact, I think, was that over and over again, Mark Zuckerberg believed that being at odds with the public was not a sign you were doing something wrong. It was a sign that you were doing something innovative. And their mantra, their motto, of course, became move fast and break things. And that motto really captured the way that they see the world.
Yeah, almost like redefining what it is to be human.
Yeah, they believed that this tool, Facebook, had that kind of power. And they came to being at a time in Silicon Valley where you had this almost messianic sense of ambition, this belief that you weren't just building computer applications. You were actually building tools that were fundamentally reshaping society. And they embraced that wholeheartedly.
Evan Osnos, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Dave.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article about Facebook is titled Ghosts in the Machine: Can Mark Zuckerberg Fix Facebook Before It Breaks Democracy? Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Charlie Kyer and Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.